From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. On Twitter this morning, President Trump escalated his rhetoric on the Russia investigation, directly calling on his Attorney General Jeff Sessions to end the FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of possible Trump campaign collusion with Russians.
Trump also tweeted in defense of his former campaign chair, Paul Manafort, on trial for tax evasion and other things, saying Manafort was being treated worse than mobster Al Capone. But Trump also distanced himself from Manafort, tweeting, "He worked for me for a very short time, and why didn't government tell me he was under investigation?" Let's convene our midweek political strategist roundtable. This week, Jamal Simmons, the Democratic strategist. Hi, Jamal.
I'm here, rested and ready.
And Paris Denard, a Republican strategist and member of the Trump White House Fellows Commission. Hi, Paris.
Hello, hello, hello.
Have to be three hellos there. Paris, let's start with you. The president directly calling on his attorney general to stop FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. You know, people say, what is he afraid of? This is America. Why doesn't Trump let the democratic process unfold? It gives the impression he's afraid of something. Your thoughts?
Well, this is nothing new. I think the president has articulated his opinion about this so-called investigation, which he calls a witch hunt, because he believes that it is outside of the scope of what it was allegedly set up to do. This is not, if it's really about justice and if it's really about investigating whether or not Russians were involved in the 2016 election, you have to look at both sides. You have to look at the Trump campaign. You have to look at the Clinton campaign. And if the Russians were involved in meddling before the 2016 campaign, then we should look at those
things,
too.
But you don't know that they're not. Yeah, but Mueller's not looking at that.
If Mueller was investigating more than just the Trump campaign, it would have been leaked, and we would have had some indication that that was the case. If he is doing that, I think that's a good thing for America. I think that's a good thing for democracy. But so far, what we've seen is something that the president calls, in his opinion, a witch hunt. Because it's far. I mean, when you look at what's happening with Manafort, the trial right now for Manafort has nothing to do with Russia, has nothing to do with the Trump campaign.
But that's what happens in an investigation. You go where the string leads you. You pull on the string and, oops, $60 million hidden in offshore accounts.
Yeah, you go where the string leads you, but this string is not attached anywhere to the Trump campaign or anywhere to the Russia investigation. So that's fine. Did he lie to investigators once before? Did he do something when he was working in political campaigns for President Reagan? Let's go for that back. This is why the scope was always too broad. Focus the scope and make it more narrow, but they didn't do that. So now it's looking at do anything and everything. And the American people are tired of it. Trump supporters are tired of it. And the president himself is tired of it.
Jamal, the scope was supposed to be about Russian interference in the election. And we now already know that they, or maybe it's not them, but it looks like it is them, are doing it again here in 2018. The Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen had strong words condemning election interference. But it does look like President Trump is not doing all that much to stop it from happening this time. In fact, he's being very friendly with Vladimir Putin and saying, let's meet again.
Yes, not only let's meet again, but please come to the White House where I will, you know, wine and dine you here with all my friends in the fine china of several administrations. Or they go to the Kremlin where Vladimir Putin would do the same. Seems a little chummy to me for someone who is attacking our democracy, has been for several years and still continues to be. I think what Paris misses in his conversation a minute ago is that they pulled on the string and the string kicked out not only the chairman of the Trump campaign, but also several other advisors, a couple of whom have pled guilty, including one who turned out to be the national security advisor for the United States of America, General Flynn. So we've got to just pay attention to the real facts that are happening here. And it looked like today the president of the United States publicly tried to obstruct justice by encouraging the attorney general to break a Department of Justice regulation and interfere in the Russian investigation.
Paris, in a Florida rally last night, President Trump once again implied that non-citizens are voting in U.S. elections. That is not true. Here he goes.
Which is why the time has come for voter ID, like everything else. Voter ID.
Now, Twitter went wild with Trump's claim that you need an ID to buy groceries. You tweeted that you do need an ID to shop at Costco. He didn't say Costco. He just said to buy groceries. But bigger point,
You know, Costco has membership, so you have to have your ID.
You have to have an ID there.
And Costco sells groceries, so if you go to Costco to buy groceries,
you
show your ID. You know, that's a fact.
That's the only one.
No, if you go to Giant or if you go to Safeway and you buy
wine while you're
buying groceries.
If you buy wine, yes, but he didn't say that, did he?
If you use a credit card or a debit card, they ask to show your ID.
Sometimes.
So the president, no, every time I go and do that, they ask for
your ID. To use a credit card, you have to use an ID every time?
Paris.
What they ask me.
Okay.
Well, they might.
Okay, but my bigger question is, what about this all about voter ID laws? Is that just him playing to his base, or is he serious about that?
Well, you just made a claim that the president is not serious about election meddling. And so I think that if Democrats and liberals care about the integrity of our election, they should care about foreign people meddling in the election. They should care about the things that happen domestically. We should want the ballot box to be as pure as possible. We should care about the integrity of every election. If you can show your ID to go to a movie, to buy groceries, to buy wine, to go to a club, to do all these things.
You don't have to show your ID to go to a G or PG rated movie.
But you know, if you go to an R rated movie and you're, ask
you're a teenager,
for your ID.
And if you're a teenager, perhaps Paris.
So is that
let's,
so?
Let's deal,
so so what I said was not incorrect. What I said was not incorrect. Stop acting like it was.
But you know what, Paris?
You have
to
show your ID. So if you want to vote, you should be able to show your ID.
But Paris, I do want to ask you. You said we implied that the president was not serious. Jamal, jump in here. The National Security Advisor John Bolton has eliminated the job of the White House Cybersecurity Coordinator. The White House has had two meetings on election security. And we
there was one last week, which looks like it was, I'm sorry, it looks like it was about 30 minutes long.
We've spoken to former FBI agents. Jeremy spoke to someone today, a security advisor. They say it has to come from the president. I mean, I know that you agree, but what happens if it doesn't come from the president?
We are all in trouble. I think that what we are looking at is that it sounds like there was a meeting last week. It's about 30 minutes long. Some of the reports are that people at the different departments are looking into this, but they're doing it in a siloed fashion. There isn't a coordinated response on how we push back the Russians who are coming at us, even coming after senators. And it seems as if the president's approach here is to say, see, it's just happening to Democrats. If the Democrats who are victims in this would just get their act together, we wouldn't have this problem. Yet we know that the Russians came to his campaign to offer them dirt. His campaign was excited to get it. We don't know whether or not they got it, but we do know that the president came out in public and said, if you can break the law and attack my opponent, you will be rewarded. The president has been rewarding Vladimir Putin by pulling us out of international agreements, going after NATO, declaring these tariffs with some of our friends and allies. It is a very tough time to be someone who wants to protect America when you have a president who wants to make friends with one of our opponents.
Paris, we are about 3 months away from the midterm elections. President Trump in his rally last night said he wants to campaign 6 or 7 days a week for Republicans running in the midterms. Here he is.
Remember I said when I'd be a little bit wild and would have a lot of fun, they'd say, he's not acting presidential. And I'd say, well, it's a lot easier to act presidential than to do what I do.
Paris, do you think that the president is going to be all over the place? Is he going to focus on certain areas as we get into the fall campaigns?
I think the president is going to go to places where he is popular and where the candidate wants him to go. He's willing and able to go there. And so, as you see with if you look at Florida, for example, when you look at that race that with DeSantis and Putnam was the favorite. Putnam was long speculated to run. He made that intention when you're in agriculture position there. That's the stepping stone to governor. And now you look at DeSantis coming in there. And it's because the president, it's a very close race. The president is helping him, and the president will help people like Arrington and McMaster and Kemp and the races in Ohio. So yeah, the president will be engaged because the president is still very popular with the base, and the president is popular with these candidates. So he should engage, and he will win.
And Jamal, I wanted to ask about a former president. President Obama weighed in today on Twitter announcing a round of endorsements. Now, our listeners, my people on my Twitter feed, Frog, hi Frog, are pointing out that President Obama didn't include Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who had that big upset in New York, the very progressive left-leaning candidate. Is that a mistake on President Obama's part?
I think there are lots of people that he didn't include in the in
Paris, are you laughing?
I am.
He is laughing.
She's the face of the Democrat Socialist Party. She should be everybody should be endorsing her and putting her on every interview possible because she
okay,
is
Jamal,
what we need to hear.
I'm not sure about the choices he made. He did include people like Antonio Delgado in New York, who's a powerful candidate, and Ben Jealous and Stacey Abrams. He's got a lot of people on that list that Democrats like. I think, though, what President Trump is doing is making it very easy for Democrats, because this is clearly now the party of Trump. And you look at somebody like DeSantis in Florida, who's just released an ad where all he talked about was trying to help his family admire Donald Trump. He's moving up in the polls. If Donald Trump is the Republican Party, that will make it very easy for a lot of Democrats to go after these
guys
in the fall.
That's Jamal Simmons, Democratic strategist, and Paris Denard, Republican strategist. And President Trump referred to Al Capone as Alphonse Capone, so we're going to go out on this. I can call you Betty, and Betty, when you call
me, you can call me out. Comedy finally has found a home, and it's Jamestown, New York. What? Way out in the western part of New York, between Buffalo to the north, Cleveland to the south, on Lake Erie, once the furniture capital of the world, that Jamestown? Yes, the National Comedy Center begins a 5-day opening today, because Jamestown is also the birthplace of the legendary Lucille Ball. Lucy will be there, along with Abbott and Costello's immortal bit about a baseball lineup.
What comedy guy's name on first base?
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who is on first, Lou?
What are you asking me for?
Now, don't get excited. I'm saying who.
I'm asking you a simple question. Who's on first?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who? I'm asking you, what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no. What's on second?
Everything from Chaplin to Chappelle. Here's a little bit of Dave Chappelle explaining why he didn't call the police after his high-end New York apartment was robbed.
Soon as I open the door, they'll be like, oh, he's still here. Open and shut case, Johnson. Apparently, this black guy broke in and hung up pictures of his family everywhere. Never seen anything like it.
As a board member of the National Comedy Center, comedian Louis Black has been through the museum. He joins us now. Louis Black, welcome back to Here and Now.
Nice to be back.
Of course, I have to ask, are you in it?
Yes, I'm in it, or I wouldn't be doing
That's
this.
Right.
Really, when you spend a lot of time sucking up to the National Comedy Center, you better be in it.
Well, and I was going to say, that must have been tough. Comedy has exploded, as we know, in the past few decades. Stand-up comedy, comedy late-night shows, comedy channels. Was it competitive? Were people, trying to slip people $100 bills to get in?
No, I think it'll continue to grow. I mean, it's what people will see is kind of like a pilot, but it's a pilot that will stagger them. There's a lot of tech behind this.
Boy, talk about some of this. For instance, there's a sort of a comedy continuum.
Well, yeah. You basically, what happens when you walk in is you put they give you a wristband that has a small kind of a computer chip. And then it will ask you when you come in to name the comics that you like. And then it registers on that chip and you go in. And so let's say you get to that comedy continuum and there's a comic that you like in particular, and you can point to that comic, and then it will literally send you to a whole bunch of comics who influenced that comedian, or it was that comedian who influenced a whole bunch of other comics, like George Carlin will appear, and then somewhere along the line there, probably Jon Stewart will appear, and Dave Chappelle will appear, and I'll appear, or if Richard Pryor was there, the same like with Chris Rock would appear. And so it's kind of astonishing. And then there's a huge wall, and if a number of people put it up, you know, they kind of do crossovers with people who like certain people, and they kind of show where there's intersections of people who are like myself, who's considered an angry comic, go figure, with somebody who's considered, let's say, a witty comic, and where we intersect and how our influences intersect. It's pretty astonishing.
Really. Oh, it sounds it. And so that kind of interactive technology and the fact that they've got this data on you will work, for instance, when you go into the section of stand-up comedy. There's going to be a kind of a comedy club setup, a darkened movie theater, a couch-filled living room. They're going to have to add a car so that would-be comedians can get in the car and they can sing karaoke what's his name does.
James Corden.
That I love.
Hello. Can you hear me? I'm in California dreaming about who we used to be. It's no secret that the both of us are running out of time.
That was amazing.
Or they can have coffee, like yes. Jerry Seinfeld does. They're going to have to do that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they will probably eventually have a, you know, at some point somewhere outside, there'll be a Jerry Seinfeld exhibit with that car. I mean, they've got, there's a George Carlin room, which is, you get a good sense of how George constructed his act or constructed a joke. There are a billion note cards that they got from Kelly Carlin, who really got me involved in the project. Hmm. Kelly gave her her father's stuff, as we like to say, to them. And,
yeah,
they
I mean, it's sort of like the Smithsonian of comedy when you have his things.
Yeah, it is. And it's and as she put it, you could take his stuff to the Smithsonian where it might end up, you know, coming out as an exhibit once in a while and be in a back room. Or you could take it to the Comedy Museum where it would be an integral part of that collection. And it's really remarkable. His note cards with the little one-liners he would write or the thoughts that he would have. You literally stand in front of a screen and push a button and one thought will come up and then another thought will come up and a punchline will come up. It's astonishing.
When we have a little bit of George Carlin, let's just listen to a little bit of him now.
Football is played in any kind of weather. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, mud. Can't read the numbers on the field. Can't read the yard markers. Can't read the players' numbers. The struggle will continue. In baseball, if it rains, we don't come out to play. I can't come out to play. It's raining out.
I was going to ask Lewis Black, you are astonished by it? I mean, even you, a time-honored pro, you're seeing something on George Carlin's note cards that's exciting you.
Yes, because it gives you an insight into him. Now, I have sat and talked to George about his process. But even with that, watching him, you know, on a screen, on stage, work on a bit as opposed to us discussing how he works is amazing. Or you walk into what is called the Blue Room, which is the those who use language that many consider to be bad words, offensive words, shocking words, you know, the seven words that George used on television. And there's a bar down there. But when you walk in, literally, the first thing you see are those words that couldn't be said, according to the FCC. And not only the words are in English, but they're in like 8 or 10 other languages. And they take a photo of you when you see the words to show the shock that might be on your face.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, like if you're on a roller coaster ride at another kind of party.
Yeah, exactly.
What is the comedy karaoke?
It's exactly the kind of thing you talk. Instead of the James Corden, you know, singing a song, this is something I actually have done where if someone would take a bit of mine and then do it, instead of, you know, singing a song, there'd be a printout, which they'd stand on a stage with a mic in what is essentially a club setting that they've set up and in front of an audience. They'll have like, you know, Jim Gaffigan's bits or Dave Attell's bits or bits by a number of comics that are, you know, well-known and that people like. And so you can go in and pick a bit that you like, and then you do like, a, you know, 50 seconds to a minute and a half of their bit.
Well, we have a little bit of comedy karaoke. Here's someone named Cameron Hurst doing George Carlin's Modern Man.
Hi, I'm Cameron Hurst. I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke-free, a diversified, multicultural, postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect.
I think this is going to be the new what to do with your bridal party before a wedding, as opposed to karaoke.
Yeah, I would hope so.
Yeah.
I would hope they would go, they would leave the comedy clubs alone where they have a tendency to gather
That's
and
right.
drive us crazy and move on to Jamestown.
Well, what they can also do is aspiring comics can actually use their own comedy, do I understand, at a laugh battle exhibit?
Well, yeah, I mean, what can happen is two folks can sit there and try to make each other laugh and then have kind of hints on the screen of certain jokes and stuff that they might use. But basically they throw things back and forth, and then Microsoft has created a recognition thing so that if the person, even if the person isn't laughing, but the fact that the person is really kind of starting to smile and is getting into the laugh mode, that person is buzzed out. Mm. So they nail them. It's kind of it's a laugh battle.
Look, the National Comedy Center in Jamestown, New York, again, is opening its first state-of-the-art museum dedicated to all of American comedy. But it's long run the Lucille Ball Desi Arnaz Museum. And for the last 25 years, they have this Lucille Ball Comedy Festival there in Jamestown. Very cool. Trevor Noah, Joan Rivers, the late Joan Rivers, Ellen DeGeneres, Paula Poundstone. I mean, this is you. which we, I'm sorry, we keep needing to remember. To mention
okay.
Lewis Black.
I'm kidding. I kid
because I love. But this, you know, this is kind of cool that this is in Jamestown, you know, upstate New York. What a great summer trip. You go to Rock and Roll in Cleveland, hop up Long Lake Erie, go to Jamestown and go to comedy, cut down to Cooperstown baseball.
You can also stop in, if you pay attention, you can stop in at Chautauqua and watch a concert or a piece of theater or dance.
The new Chautauqua.
Which is like 20 minutes from there.
Right.
You can gamble at the casino in Seneca. You can get up to Niagara Falls. And then you're right, and hit Cooperstown and come home.
Let's go. Lewis Black, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
And the National Comedy Center in lovely Jamestown, New York, begins its opening celebration today. And since we kept leaving out Lewis, here he is, something we can air, the title bit from his second comedy album, The End of the Universe.
Imagine my surprise when I left the comedy club one day and walked to the end of the block, and there on one corner was a Starbucks. And across the street from that Starbucks, in the exact same building as that Starbucks, there was a Starbucks. I looked back and forth thinking the sun was playing tricks with my eyes. But there was a Starbucks across from a Starbucks. And that, my friends, is the end of the universe.
Apple is within striking distance of becoming the world's first trillion-dollar company. Apple stock jumped more than 5% this morning after it reported better than expected earnings in its third quarter. And Tesla is expected to release its earnings after the market closes today. Its stock has been falling in recent months. Joining us now is Claire Sebastian, correspondent for CNN Money. She's in New York. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Jeremy.
So first of all, Apple, what are some of the reasons it had such a strong quarter?
Well, that was really one key reason, and that is the iPhone. The thing you have to know about Apple is the iPhone is king. It is the cash cow for this company. It's more than half of their revenues, well over half, in fact. And what was really interesting this time around is while the amount of iPhones, the unit sales that they sold, were basically flat year on year, the price that people are paying for iPhones is going up. Mm-hmm. It was the average price was $724 this year versus $606 the same time last year. So what we're seeing here is despite some skepticism from some people about the $1,000 price tag on that iPhone 10, people are paying more for their iPhones. And that is what drove iPhone revenues up 20% in this quarter. That is really what is driving the growth in this company.
So when you look at the fact that the cell phone market is reaching saturation, does that mean Apple is now going to need to diversify? They can't just keep raising prices forever on that iPhone 10 or whatever the next iPhone is.
Right. Well, we would hope that they wouldn't do that. No, they're certainly diversifying. This is something that they are already, to an extent, succeeding at. Services was a particular bright spot in this earnings season. That was up 31% in the last quarter. That's things that people subscribe to, like Apple Pay, like iCloud, like Apple Music, Apple Care. And subscription has the advantage of being a more predictable, more stable business. So that is something that investors are looking at. And they also have a unit, Jeremy, called Other Products, which contains the Apple Watch, Apple TV, AirPods, the HomePod speaker, things like that. And revenues there were up more than 35%. So still, you know, they are reliant on the iPhone. It is, as I said, more than half of revenues, but they are doing well in other departments as well.
What about Tesla? What are you watching for as it comes out with its earnings later today?
Right. So the big question here is how much money they're burning through. The Model 3, their mass market car that's supposed to propel them into the mainstream, has been beset by delays. They did meet a crucial milestone at the end of the quarter where they started to manufacture 5,000 cars a week, which they've been trying to do for the last 6 months. But I think the question for investors is how much is that going to be costing the company? Cash burn has been a real problem for Tesla. They burned through $700 billion in the last quarter. There are speculations out there that they'll have to raise money. They'll have to go to the market and raise cash. And I think that is what investors are going to be watching above all else when they report today.
Well, and they'll probably also be watching the leader of Tesla, Elon Musk, who has been acting a little bit erratically lately. We remember that he accused one of the Thai cave rescuers of being a pedophile. He was very combative during a conference call with analysts in May. How much does his behavior influence the stock value?
You know, it really does. Tesla is a volatile stock at the best of time, and Elon Musk's behavior has made it worse, essentially. It fell sharply after that conference call, even though in the last quarter, earnings actually beat expectations. And it fell again after that tweet about the Thai cave rescue, which for many really crossed the line. Right. If he hadn't backed it up with fact at all. And it even prompted one top tech analyst to write an open letter telling him to take a Twitter sabbatical. And Jeremy, he's been at it again overnight, trolling hedge fund manager David Einhorn on Twitter after a report surfaced that he hadn't renewed the lease on his Tesla. But so I think we'll be watching really closely okay. What happens on this call.
Claire Sebastian at CNN Money, thank you.
Thank you.
A cricket star turned philanthropist and politician is poised to become Pakistan's new prime minister. 65-year-old Imran Khan led his PTI party to victory in last month's parliamentary elections. He's expected to be sworn in before August 14th, which is Independence Day in Pakistan. Here's Khan speaking through an interpreter after his party won the election.
We will be accountable for everything, and we will be pledging simplicity. And I promise you that the public, that the tax money of the public, I am responsible and I will protect it.
Joining us now is Sikandar Kermani, the BBC's Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent. He's in Islamabad. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And let's start with where Imran Khan came from. He was born in Lahore in Pakistan. Tell us more about him and his family.
So, yes, Imran Khan was born in Lahore. His father was a civil engineer. So it was a well-off family. But importantly, it wasn't an overtly political family. And that makes a lot of difference in Pakistan, where politics is often dominated by a number of influential families where power is passed down effectively from father to son to grandson. So he went to Aitchison College, which is one of the best schools in Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And from there, he then went on to England to study in Worcester and after that to Oxford.
And then he eventually married a wealthy British woman. He was a close friend of Princess Diana. Does that background play any role in who he is today?
So as a cricketer, he was very well known in England for his cricketing prowess, but also for his good looks. He was a regular at exclusive nightclubs. He was seen as something of a Casanova.
He looks like a Hollywood star, even today.
Absolutely. He's got this long, well, he certainly had, and he still does have, this kind of long flowing hair. Of course, he was a sportsman, a great sportsman. So, you know, he was in very good shape. He never drank alcohol, he says, but he certainly went out to a lot of parties. And he had the girls of Chelsea swooning after him, really. And he was very much part of that kind of elite British set. But after retiring from cricket, he became more religious. He has said that he never really felt fully comfortable in that kind of party lifestyle. But he has said that his time in the West, in England, influenced him in the way that it showed him how important it was to have a kind of welfare state where all sections of society, rich and poor, are looked after, where people are guaranteed a certain level of service by the state. But he's not necessarily the kind of westernized liberal person that his background would suggest. At times, he's been quite critical of westernized liberals within Pakistan. At one stage, he acquired a nickname of Taliban Khan because his critics say he was soft on extremists. Now, he denies that and he says, look, I was just advocating for peace talks with militant groups because he felt that was the only way that you could solve the issues that we were seeing in Pakistan where there was a lot of militant violence. So he's a bit of a contradiction in many ways. And a lot of people in Pakistan are waiting to see what kind of leader, what side of Imran Khan will come out
His critics also say that he is too close to the military in Pakistan. I want to listen here to Michael Kugelman from the Wilson Center, who we talked to about these allegations that Khan is very close to the Pakistani military and that they would engineer his election.
Yeah, and of course that Khan and the military will say no, not at all. But I think it's quite clear that the military sees the PTI and Khan as really the best possible outcome in terms of who should be leading the next government.
What is true about Khan's ties to the military?
Well, it's certainly, as you heard in that clip, it's certainly what his critics say. Now, Imran Khan categorically denies that. The army denies interfering in politics. So what can we kind of decipher as being true or not? Well, the campaign environment in the lead up to the polls saw a lot of allegations of what some people called pre-poll rigging. EU election observers called it a systematic attempt to undermine the ruling party. At the same time, we can't deny that Imran Khan is genuinely very, very, very popular. So it's really hard to say what effect on the vote this kind of political atmosphere in the lead up to the polls had. Would he have been elected if it had been a different atmosphere or not? It's really hard to say because his message does genuinely resonate with a lot of people.
From the perspective of the United States, two of the most important issues when it comes to Pakistan are the war in Afghanistan and terrorism in general. What do you think Imran Khan's election means for those issues?
Well, certainly for the war in Afghanistan, I mean, in the past, Imran Khan has voiced his opposition to U.S. military intervention in the country. Now we see that he seems to be rowing back a bit on those positions. Certainly in interviews that I've had with him, he's recognized that there's a definite need for Pakistan to engage with the U.S. There does seem to be a kind of shift in Pakistan's attitude towards Afghanistan in recent months, though, which seems to be driven by the military's attitude to the conflict there, because fundamentally, foreign policy in Pakistan is controlled, always has been controlled, and many suspect will be controlled for a great deal longer by the Pakistani military. And the military in Pakistan seems to now be more reconciled to the idea of a peaceful resolution to the conflict in Afghanistan. For a long time, it seems to have regarded the Afghan Taliban as a kind of proxy force, which it can use to influence events in Afghanistan and to use as a buffer against Indian influence coming into Afghanistan, because the Indians have been very close to the current Afghan government and previous Afghan governments.
Since you brought up India, we know that Pakistan is a nuclear power and so is its neighbor, India. What does Khan ruling Pakistan mean for the relationship with India?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, in his speech, Imran Khan said, kind of made very positive noises, saying that if India takes one step towards Pakistan, Pakistan will take two steps towards India. Actually, the relationship between Pakistan and India, some people have suspected, is really behind what the falling out between the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and the Pakistani military, because Nawaz Sharif was seen as being very pro-India, and the military seemed to be a bit skeptical about that and not want him to move so fast. However, you know, a lot of civilian leaders in the past, once they've come into power, have always tried to improve relationships with India because they recognize that a better trading relationship is better for both countries' economies. So we could see some kind of improving relationship between Pakistan and India if both the Pakistani military and Imran Khan's government are on the same page in wanting to improve those relations.
Sikandar, I want to ask you about one more thing, which is China. In his victory speech, Khan talked about China. He said, "We want to learn from China how they brought 700 million people out of poverty. The other thing we can learn from China is the measures they have taken against corruption, how they have arrested more than 400 ministers there." He sent out a tweet in Chinese after his victory. How does China play into the future of Pakistan and how Imran Khan sees the future of Pakistan?
China has a big influence in Pakistan, and a lot of that comes through a project called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is a series of infrastructure projects totaling kind of over $60 billion worth of investment, which aims to link Western China with the Arabian Sea via Pakistan. And now a lot of politicians and military officials in Pakistan view this as this series of projects as really key to the country's future. It's often called a game changer. And that's engendered a lot of really goodwill towards China in Pakistan. The US has also kind of given Pakistan a lot of money over the past, but it's often not viewed anywhere near as favorably, partly because China doesn't seem to attach the same kind of political conditions. There are, however, concerns amongst some analysts that this series of projects could lead to large levels of debt in Pakistan, that Pakistan will have to repay loans to China, and that will give China a large amount of leverage over Pakistani policy.
That's the BBC's Sikandar Kermani talking with us from Islamabad, Pakistan, about the new prime minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, who is expected to be sworn in this month. Sikandar, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
This was supposed to be the day that Cody Wilson and his company Defense Distributed were to begin legal downloading of blueprints for 3D printed plastic guns. But as you've probably heard, a federal judge in Seattle blocked Wilson after a lawsuit from 8 states and the District of Columbia claimed that would be a bell that cannot be unrung. But hasn't that bell already rung? Nir Gershenfeld is director of the Center for Bits and Atoms at MIT. His new book is Designing Reality: What is the Impact If Anybody Can Make Anything? Full disclosure, I've been honored to be in his home, where right next to the washer dryer is his 3D printer and other maker stuff. And Neil, you're part of a movement to get more of this out to people. And you say it's not that you're for or against printing guns, but we're all looking at this the wrong way?
Absolutely. 3D printed guns is scary, but all of the reactions are really misdirected. They're missing the point. It's scary. There's good things we can do. It's not what's being discussed.
Well, so what are the good things we can do?
Let's start with what's the misdirection. This can't be controlled by passing a rule. That makes as much sense as saying the government is going to forbid file sharing.
Well, because, and let's just remind ourselves, Cody Wilson first put these blueprints out in 2013. He says they were downloaded 100,000 times then, so that's exponentially probably grown. He put them out on Friday because he was afraid they'd be blocked. 1,000 people downloaded them then. So this horse is out of the barn.
So the horse is out of the barn and the barn is gone. So you right. can't control it. But more than that, the other thing that's misdirected is current consumer 3D printers make really mediocre guns. Guns are easily available, but not just that. Making a gun is an easy hardware store project. You know, with a pipe and a little striker in a hardware store, you can make a gun.
Right.
Creating a gun is just a very, very low threshold. That's why the coverage is wrong.
But is there something different because these are plastic, so they're not detectable as you go through like a metal detector? They don't have serial numbers on them?
Again, that's an easy hardware store project. And the not detectable, in fact, is a distraction as we move from metal detectors to millimeter wave detectors that can see them. One straightforward thing that's a huge loophole is ammo is harder to make than the gun. And ammo is really poorly controlled. And so if you look at access to ammo, that's not really part of the map.
Well, but it's not going to be because we have a National Rifle Association. I mean, the president himself, when he said, I'm concerned about this, I'm consulting the NRA.
Right.
We're never going to control ammunition.
That would be the obvious thing to do in a coherent world. I'm not scared about 3D printed guns for all the reasons we just talked about. What is scary is synthetic bio, the idea that in your basement you could make a plague, a virus. Mm. That's much scarier. It's the same story. It's digital data turned into things. These are much more threatening things. What's worked so far to control the scary threat of synthetic bio is two things that are applicable to the guns. One is surveillance to try to look to see what's happening where. But the missed one is providing incentives to opt in. Rather than doing this by yourself in a basement and going off the rails, doing it in social settings. So you're familiar with, we've started over 1,000 community mm-hmm. fab labs. All the time people come in to make guns. And what happens?
They do in your fab labs?
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, this has been one of your things. We've talked to you about this. It's putting all of this in more of a public communal place where people
right.
can do it together.
And so they want to make guns. They want to make weapons. They want to make mech warriors. And then what happens is they get integrated.
Wait, mech warriors?
Oh, your big suits you wear and march around and okay. are bigger and stronger than you were. and in the social setting, they get integrated into a community. The community helps steer, provide oversight, connect to more constructive projects. And so there's really interesting legislation right now in the House and the Senate, bipartisan, to make a national Fab Lab network as in the national interest. In the same way we have universal access to communication and computation, this would be universal access to digital fabrication as just sort of a right of anybody in the country.
Yeah, but, you know, you're acting as if a community can morally guide somebody doing something. Cody Wilson is somebody who's opted out of a lot of communities. He's not only the Defense Distributed founder, he's the man behind Hateron, which is an alt-right website for people like Richard Spencer, white supremacists, who've been kicked off other websites. Mm-hmm. So he's already kind of an alternate shadow, dark world guy. You're not going to get him to go to a Fab Lab.
He may not, but we've run these labs in shooting war zones. We've had them in Jalalabad, Afghanistan. We have them in Belfast and Derry. We have them in these places of intense sectarian conflict. And consistently what happens is people come in from the community and connect. And so there's always going to be outliers, and they're going to get access to guns, and no rule can prevent that.
Yeah, whether it's a gun or a plastic printed gun.
But statistically, we can deal with much more of the population. I mean, a great vignette of this is we have one of these labs on the Giza Plateau
in
Egypt. And during the Morsi riots, we were really worried. And we called alarmed, and they left, and they said the kids in the community who had no interest in sectarian conflict took the day off to go work in the lab. And I think that's getting to the heart of it. There will always be bad people who do bad things, and they'll get guns, and they've had guns for perpetuity, and we can't stop that. But what we can do is provide incentives to maximize the opportunity for people to come in to do this in social settings, not in darkness in the corner of their room.
Okay, we've just scratched the surface here. Neil Gershenfeld, as we said, you have this new book, Designing Reality. What is the impact if anybody can make anything? Neil, Professor, thank you.
My pleasure, always.
And we will have him back to talk more about that book. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.